of Atlantic Richfield versus Whiting Oil and Gas, case number 2010 SC 688. Are both parties ready?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Let me take care of a couple of housekeeping matters. Argument is scheduled for an hour, so half hour to side to a side. ARCO will have to keep track of your time. And when you have to argue, please tell us who you are and who you represent. And lastly, you'll see some of us, not all of us, using iPads. This is for the benefit of the audience as well. We're not searching the internet. Actually, all our briefs and notes and our links to the cases in the record are on the iPad. So I just want to let you know that. Let's start.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Shannon Stevenson on behalf of the petitioner, Atlantic Richfield Company. In this case, our opponent, Equity, invites this court to state a rule that requires mandatory reformation of commercial instruments that violate the common law rule against perpetuities in order to make effective such instruments that were otherwise void ab initio. The implications of such a rule are potentially substantial and the consequences largely unknowable. Such a rule would apply to commercial instruments executed prior to 1991 and could reach back and require reformation of such instruments executed over the last 100 years or even more. Mandatory reformation of these instruments could affect title to mineral rights, oil and gas rights, as well as commercial and residential real property, and potentially disrupt long-settled expectations regarding title. This court, however, can only state such a rule if it finds two things. First, it must find that the legislature clearly expressed its intent for the reformation provision at issue here to apply retroactively to commercial instruments. And second, that such retroactive application does not violate Colorado's constitutional prohibition on retrospective legislation. It is Atlantic Richfield's position that neither of these requirements can be satisfied, and the court must reverse the district court's judgment and hold the option void and unenforceable. Let me begin with the first hurdle that Equity must clear in this case, and that is to show that the legislature clearly expressed its intent that this reformation provision apply retroactively to commercial instruments. In doing so, I will look at the typical things that we look at when we're interpreting a statute, but I want to do that with the court bearing in mind that the standard that must be met here is whether the legislature clearly expressed its intent that retroactive application occur here. And the reason why that standard is important and exists is because it tells us that the legislature affirmatively considered the potential problems that retroactive application might pose, and that it decided after weighing the pros and cons of such retroactive application that that was indeed what it wanted to do. In looking at the statute, I want to look at the specific terms of the reformation provision at issue, the legislative history of the statute, other sections in the Act, as well as the purpose of the statute. But again, looking at these through the lens of, do they reflect the legislature's considered judgment that this provision should apply retroactively to commercial instruments? The first term I want to look at in the specific language of the reformation provision, which is 1511-1106-2, is the term interested person. The provision allows an interested person to seek reformation. Interested person is a term defined by the probate code, and it's defined to include a number of different people, but any person who is an interested person must have an interest in the estate of a decedent or a trust estate. Clearly, that is not a situation that is going to come up when you're talking about a commercial option entered into between two commercial parties. Second, the reformation provision authorizes the court to reform an instrument. Like interested person, court is a term that is defined by the probate code. And it's defined to be the court or the division thereof that has jurisdiction over probate matters. So again, a definition provided by the probate code that specifically limits its scope to probate matters. The reformation provision next talks about reforming a disposition. disposition is not defined by the code, but it is a legal term of art that usually means transference of property subject to a deed or in furtherance by a deed or will. So again, we're talking about another term that is strongly suggestive of the probate context. And finally, the reformation provision allows the court to reform the instrument, the disposition, in order to most closely preserve the transferor's manifested plan of distribution. Again, distribution is not a term defined by the probate code, but it is addressed extensively within the probate code, specifically with respect to the probate of wills. And distribution is another legal term of art that means the dividing of an estate. When you read all of these words together within this provision, it seems clear that the drafters of the provision were not focused on how this provision would apply to commercial instruments. There's simply no indication that this reformation provision would have application anywhere outside of a probate court dealing with probate matters.
Did this come out of any study provision, interim legislative committee, probate subcommittee, the bar, or anything like that?
Yes, Your Honor. So the probate section of the bar submitted this legislation to the legislature. And that sort of goes to my next point, which is the legislative history of this section. As you just brought up, this was legislation that was proposed by the probate section of the bar. It was presented to the legislature along with other amendments to the probate code. It was entitled an act concerning the probate code, and it was placed in the intestate succession and wills section of the code. Again, all of these things suggesting that anyone reviewing this statute is viewing it and thinking that its application is going to be with respect to probate instruments and viewing it through that lens. The statute was also based on a Model Act. And the Model Act does have comments specific to this section that includes the reformation provision in the Model Act, which is similar to the one here. And what I would note about that is in talking about reformation, retroactive reformation, the Model Act references four cases, all of which deal with testamentary instruments, trusts and wills. So again, the legislative history doesn't contain anything that would suggest to us anything different than the provision itself suggests, which is that the drafters of this legislation were thinking of this provision and how it would apply to probate instruments, not commercial instruments like the option at issue here. If you look at the Act more broadly, there are two other sections that contain the exact same verbiage as the reformation provision at issue here. Those are sections 1104.5 and 1106.5. Now, these sections we know apply only to probate instruments because they only apply to instruments that were created after the passage of the Act, and the Act doesn't apply to any commercial instruments that were created after its passage. So when we look at those sections and we say, well, here are these words used, and we know in this context those words apply only to probate instruments, and then you have the identical language used in section 1106.2, again suggesting that we want to apply all of those provisions consistently and that they all reflect a probate purpose only. Equity's response to all of this is, yes, but the overwhelming purpose of this act was to mitigate the effect of the common law rule against perpetuities, and we don't dispute that. But the purpose of a statute by itself simply isn't sufficient to overcome the hurdle that you have to show to have a statute apply retroactively. Anytime you have a new statute that is either abrogating the common law or changing a previously existing statute, there's a good chance it's going to be articulating a new and important purpose that the legislature is attempting to embody for the future. But that is a completely separate question from whether the legislature intended the statute to apply.
Well, this reformation provision has to reach back, however, right?
It does, Your Honor. And I think what's important here is that the language is so strongly suggestive that it was only considered that it would reach back to probate instruments, not commercial instruments. And since the significance of the rule requiring a clear statement of legislative intent is so that we know the legislature thought through the specific implications, the fact that it appears to have not included any thought about commercial instruments is significant in determining whether it sufficiently articulated clear legislative intent to apply to commercial instruments.
And the court has discretion whether or not to reform an instrument?
No, the court does not have discretion as to.
So it has to.
It must, correct. Okay. And I think that is an important point with respect to the policy implications of where this rule might lead. The people who drafted this legislation, I have no doubt, were very smart probate, trust, and estate lawyers who really understood how these provisions might work with respect to probate instruments. But I question whether they sufficiently had considered the implication of such a statute to various and varied and many types of instruments that could be out there floating around for, you know, literally 100 years that could be mandatorily required to be reformed by this act. You could have an option executed in 1920 that provided for a 100-year option period that would allow someone to, you know, purchase the land of a Coors Field for $10 an acre. I think, you know, the traditional approach to that would be say, well, that's void for violating the rule against perpetuities. But under this act, that option would mandatorily have to be reformed and brought into compliance with the rule of perpetuities and be made enforceable. And I don't think that the legislature considered that type of scenario when adopting this reformation provision. There's nothing in the language of the statute that suggests that they did. There's nothing in the legislative history that suggests that they did. And while they articulated an important policy going forward, they simply cannot reach back and make otherwise vested rights no longer vested by applying this statute.
Where do they articulate this policy you're talking about?
The policy to mitigate the common law rule against perpetuities.
Right.
I believe it's in the last section of the act, and it says, and I agree, it's not as clearly stated as some statutes might, but it does say the purpose of this act is to supersede the common law rule against perpetuities going forward.
And it says specifically, as it was amended in 2006, which I think is when they added the abolish language, right?
Mm-hmm.
It says with regard to non-vested property interests or whatever. So is the question, even with regard to the policy, to what they were trying to do, to what they wrote in 1107, have to do with whether these non-vested interests they're talking about are only ones to which the Part 11 applies or are something greater?
Let me make sure I understand your question. In terms of this articulation of policy to supersede the common law rule against perpetuities, right, does that itself only have prospective effect?
Well, actually, I thought you seemed to be moving in the direction that there was a clear statement of policy to abolish the rule altogether, but they just may not have considered enough in deciding to do that. I'm asking the question whether from the wording there is even a clear indication that there was an indication to an intent to abolish the rule against perpetuities with regard to all contracts, agreements.
Let me make sure my position is clear. I do believe that the act going forward fairly strongly suggests its intent to reduce the effect of the common law rule against perpetuities.
With regard to all
instruments, correct.
Okay.
In fact, going forward, the act does not place any new rule against perpetuities on commercial instruments. But the question I think we are dealing with here is, what is the retroactive effect of the statute? And can it go back and change rights that were created?
By the retroactive effect, you're talking about the reformation provisions then.
Correct, yeah.
And so is the question for you then, did they intend to require the reformation of contracts as to which the new statutory rule would not even apply?
I think that's correct, yes. You know, I think what equity has argued is, well, that doesn't make any sense. If you're not going to subject new instruments to the new rule, then why would you not accept them or include them under the reformation provision as well? And I think, again, there are many reasons to that, but the rubric that we're under is, how do we know when legislation can be applied retroactively? And that's what the reformation does. It reaches back and changes past transactions. And there we have to know that the legislature considered and decided that it wanted to reach back retroactively and had considered the pros and cons of doing that. And I think the evidence is overwhelming that they did not consider that with respect to commercial instruments and simply expressed no clear intent whatsoever that that reformation provision apply retroactively to commercial instruments.
Also, is your argument then, I understand you're basing it on intent, but is there any reason why this would not apply to commercial transactions? Are you entirely basing your argument on the intent of the legislature, or is there some something deeper going on here.
No, and specifically, of course, we raised the issue that applying the reformation provision retroactively in this instance to a commercial instrument deprives Atlantic Richfield of its vested contract rights. And as you might imagine, I think this would be a common problem, and you've seen it in the cases where parties have made this very argument. And I think the reason why is because when you have two commercial parties contracting and they enter into an option, say, that's void ab initio, then the property is immediately vested in the grantor of the void option. So for instance, in this case, Equity and Atlantic Richfield signed this option agreement. It's void. The property remains vested in Atlantic Richfield, which has unencumbered fee simple title to the property. It could do anything it wanted to with the property going forward. And so by reforming the void option, essentially the court created a property interest in favor of Equity that didn't otherwise exist. And so,
yes. Tell me how you read on the non-vested property interest or a power of appointment arising out of a non-donative transfer. How do you look at that? 1A, it's 105-1A, that language.
Right. I think the section that you're referring to, Your Honor, says that the statutory rule against perpetuities act created a new rule against perpetuities that is somewhat less onerous than the old common law rule. And that section says we're not going to subject instruments, non-donative instruments, commercial instruments, to this new statutory rule against perpetuities, which is going to apply to probate instruments. So that's how I read that. It's purely prospective.
So effectively, then, you're saying that with this provision, what can be inferred from that is that non-donative interests or transfers or commercial contracts are wholly excluded going forward.
Correct.
Under this statutory provision.
Yes.
Can I take you in a somewhat different direction? Looking at 1106.2, the reformation provision, it seems like the reformation provision isn't even triggered unless it's been determined that some non-vested property interest has been determined in a judicial proceeding to violate the state's rule against perpetuities as that rule existed prior to the effective date.
Right.
My first question for you is, do you read that to be a strictly technical reading of that common law rule, or because it is a common law rule, the rule as our court has interpreted it? Where I'm headed with all of this is that, for example, in our Cambridge case, we made very clear that we don't apply it mechanically to every situation. We sort of take into account the purposes underpinning the common law rule, and where those purposes aren't served, we don't necessarily apply it. So I'm wondering, in terms of the threshold determination about whether the rule has even been violated, how does that play into this reformation provision? What is the trial court supposed to do?
Well, in this case, the trial court did conclude that this option violated the common law rule. And that's why he...
But only in a strict technical application sense, right? I mean, not taking into account Cambridge or other judicial decisions that might take a contrary view.
Sure. I would disagree with that. I mean, the exact arguments that Equity presents to this court now as to whether or not the common law rule should have applied to this option in the first place, it presented all of those arguments to the district court. And the district court said, I've considered all of these arguments. I find that citing Crossroads, Cambridge, Atchison, all the cases that were in effect at the time that the option was entered, I find that the common law rule of this state does in fact apply here and that its policies are violated by this option. And so the common law rule does void this option. Then of course he went on to reform it under the statutory reformation provision.
Assuming we agree with you that the reformation provision does not apply retroactively,
yes,
doesn't that send us right back to the common law rule here? I mean, are you saying that the trial court's ruling with respect to the violation of the common law rule is binding or cannot be revisited as a legal conclusion by us?
It would be my position that the trial court's ruling on whether or not the common law rule applied, I believe that is an alternate grounds for affirmance that Equity is urging that the court should consider reversing that decision. I think that it is a factual decision. I think that the district court in this case was aware of all of the circumstances surrounding the execution of this option and how it came into being and what its effect was, and considered all of the policies that were articulated by Colorado's common law cases, Cambridge and Atchison and Crossroads and found that the policies applied. So I think it is not a de novo standard of review. We struggled actually to find a case that had a similar set of facts for a standard of review, and we cited a Marriage of Williamson, which indicates that for the factual findings, it's an abuse of discretion standard, but certainly something higher than de novo, given the court's familiarity with all the facts in this case.
So I would ask you, just speaking here today, how exactly are the purposes served in this case, given this option?
The purposes of
the rule.
Sure. So to begin with, if you look at Cambridge, Cambridge was evaluating whether the common law rule applied to a right of first refusal. And in doing so, it clearly distinguished rights of first refusal from options like this one. And the important points that were articulated by the court in Cambridge were an option is severely impairs alienability because, one, it gives a third party the absolute right to demand that you sell your property regardless of whether you want to or not, and because it creates the risk that you will sell your property at a price that is far below market price. And that, of course, is exactly what happened here. Equity exercised the option, forced Atlantic Richfield to sell the property when it didn't want to, for pennies on the dollar for what the fair market value of the property was.
And so, didn't ARCO in this context have a right to revoke that at any time?
The option did contain a right to revoke, but I don't think that really implicates the purposes of the common law rule. The right to revoke didn't make it any more likely that the interest would vest in less than 21 years. And there were significant factual issues related to the revocability that I think informed the court's judgment here. Atlantic Richfield entered into this option in the first place because it had made this $26 million investment in oil shale research, and which had not been fruitful at that point. And this was its last chance to get any return on that investment. Equity said, we'll continue doing this oil shale research, but you have to give us this option so that we have a chance to recoup some of our value if we're successful. And, you know, so as a practical matter, there were real restraints on the revocability of the option. The other piece I want to address is articulated in Atchison, which talks about it holds the right of first refusal to violate the common law rule because the right of first refusal isn't tied to the property ownership, and therefore it can be transferred and create problems with title and marketability further down the road to the extent you can't track down the owner of that property interest. We had the exact same situation here. The option, equity could have transferred to any number of parties and created a problem where Atlantic Richfield couldn't find the owner, or Atlantic Richfield's successor couldn't find the owner, which would also make it impossible to actually cancel the option. And finally on that point, I'll note that the parties themselves in the option described the fact that it would create a cloud on title. So I think they clearly believed that these instruments, you know, were meaningful and did create a cloud on title. And finally on that point, you know, equity hasn't cited any cases where a court has said an option that is subject to being revoked doesn't violate the purposes of the common law rule. The cases that it cites all concern a situation where there is no other person with a property interest. For instance, in Fitzpatrick, the holder of the power of appointment had a right to choose. I'm either going to vest all this property in myself, or I'm going to have this trust continue and the property can be used by others. That was not Atlantic Richfield's situation. Equity had an existing immediate right to demand that Atlantic Richfield sell the property. It was subject to revocation, but they had the power at that time. And that did shift a burden onto ARCO, which of course in this case played out with it having to, with the court ordering it to sell the property for far below its fair market value. And so I think that the policies of the common law rule actually are implicated in this case. Colorado's case law at the time that this option was entered into unequivocally held, without really much policy analysis at all, that commercial options to purchase real estate were subject to the rule. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Good afternoon, may it please the court. Counsel, I'm Keith Tooley of Welborn Sullivan Mack and Tooley. I represent Equity Oil Company and Whiting Oil and Gas Corporation. I'd like to begin, if I may, with a metaphor that I think would be useful. The old common law rule of perpetuities was like an old rotting tree. It was a tree that courts had been chipping away against, that treatises had criticized over decades. And our legislature made the determination to cut down that tree at its trunk. This Uniform Act was designed to get rid of the rule against perpetuities. 1107 makes that clear. The Act ends by saying, for this Part 11, all of it, you want to presume that the we're going to honor the intent of parties. We're going to the first section of 1107 and the second section of 1107, that's 1107-2, abolish and supersede the rule against perpetuities for all purposes going forward. Commercial instruments like this one, non-donative transfers under 1105, no longer subject to the rule against perpetuities.
I ask you there the same type of question I ask your opponent, and that is, so the language which was added in 2006, it used to just say when this was adopted that it supersedes the common law rule against perpetuities, supersedes, but didn't say abolished. In 2006, we added and abolishes the rule for non-vested interests created after May 31st, 1991.
Right.
Now, so your reading of that is the intent when they used that phrase non-vested interests in this section, they meant all non-vested interests, even though earlier they've made clear that the statutory rule of against perpetuities that they've created does not apply to all non-vested interests, but only certain ones.
Yes, I think the helpful language is the language that says all matters which could be raised under the rule against perpetuities. All matters that addresses. And I think going forward, and I think counsel concedes, going forward, commercial instruments, probate or not, are no longer subject to the common law rule. We're going to replace it with the statutory rule. And that statutory rule is now put in its place and doesn't extend to non-donative transfers such as 1105 addresses. 1106, of course, looks backwards. And it says, with respect to any interest that's going to violate this rule against perpetuities under the old common law, you are to presume that the intention was that that interest be valid, and you're to reform with a savings clause. This was the equitable remedy many courts had applied for years. The Uniform Act was designed exactly to follow that, what I would call an elegant and just solution looking backwards. It ties to the intent of the parties at the time, takes away nothing, implies no new duty, no new obligation, and no new disability.
I guess my concern is that the words in 1106 don't help me any more than the words in 1107, because they still talk about the non-vested interest, and actually there it goes on to talk about or power of appointment. But sort of the question then, and I think it was the question of the dissenting voice in the Court of Appeals, is, so is it implicit that they're referring to those non-vested property interests to which this part applies, or all non-vested property interests? And when it comes to the, which is the section 1105, that actually talks about when the statutory rule will apply, the new rule that it's creating, It is a little more express and indicates exactly which non-donative transfers or interests this will apply to. And so the question is, when it refers to non-vested interests, property interests, and powers of appointment after that, is it referring back to these ones or to everything in the world?
I think it's a great question. I've spent a lot of time with the statute, as you can imagine. And it's clear when you look at the Uniform Act and the design of the statute as a whole that we're getting rid of this common law rule, replacing it with a statutory rule that is going to be narrow and it's going to stick to the purposes of that rule. And the non-donative language there in 1105 to me suggests that there's only certain circumstances where that new statutory rule will apply. But 1107 is really helpful. Any matter covered by the old common law rule, the clear policy in 1107 is we're done with that old common law rule. That's the whole reason for the Uniform Act. And enough's enough. Now, the tree has been felled. And now counsel for ARCO argues that still one branch stands. That this remote branch stands. Even though the legislature...
I like your analogy. But her argument, I think, is has we have to deal with that a lot of the language in this whole act sounds like, you know, probate stuff, right?
No doubt, Your Honor.
So how do we square that with your argument about 1107, which is, you're right, says to any matter relating to the validity? You're right about that, and that's what it says. But how do we square that with the specific language, interest, distribution, you know, so forth?
By looking
which at sounds the, like we're dealing with, you know, trusts and estates and probate code.
Sure. By looking at the roots and the trunk of this tree, we all know that this started back with the Duke of Norfolk or whatever happened in Jolly Old England, worried about the dead hand from past generations coming forward and the vesting problems that that would cause. It's a real property question to start with, and a property question generally to begin with. True, it most often comes up in estate planning. Undeniably, that's the case. But that doesn't mean that this rule only was implicated in probate matters, and the August case is a classic example. Even though that was a claim preclusion case, that was really our roadmap in this case. Both the majority opinion and the dissenting opinion looked at that, and the reading was, as I read that case, this reformation provision applies to commercial transactions. That's what Argus was.
Was that ever at issue in Argus? Or did everybody just take that for granted because the question was, could you raise it anyway because of collateral
stuff? I think it's fair to say it wasn't the issue and there's not a holding there. I concede that it's dicta, but it's beautiful dicta. Both in the majority opinion and in the dissent. Take either or both put together. Clearly, the reaction to this statute would apply to a commercial transaction.
Why do you think it was put right here in the probate code?
Well, you need to put it somewhere. If you put it in the property code, would it not apply to probate? I think the Borghese case, if I'm pronouncing the name right, says the placement of a statute in a particular place in the book doesn't answer the question, what's the purpose of the statute?
Surely that's rather broad, though. I mean, one might say for some purposes that a statute would have applicability outside, and or at least by analogy, and maybe applicability outside of its location. But surely everybody would agree, wouldn't they, that there's something about placing a statute in a particular context that has to do with the intention of about what it will apply to?
I could not argue that that's irrelevant, but I certainly think the case law teaches that that is not a controlling indicator of what the policy of the statute was. And that is a good segue to the earlier question. What about the policy to begin with? If you look at Crossroads, this case is similar to that. Here's the similarity in Cambridge. This option was revocable. The parties here are co-tenants. 50-50 owners, equity on the property to start with, conveyed 50%, they're co-tenants. They both have 100% right to use the entire estate. Every grain of sand, every molecule of oil they own together. Crossroads teaches that in a lease, an option to buy the lease premises, you don't apply the rule. Rationale? Because there's an incentive of the tenant to develop the property. It's not showing a thing. You know who the tenant is. You know who you go to with respect to the option. Makes sense. Same policy here. They're co-tenants. It's the same property, not other property. It's revocable, so ARCO could have eliminated it at any moment. It's not fixed price. The price is based on ARCO's change in its oil price. So take those together, it's hard to see how this would violate the purposes of the rule to start with.
I was just going to ask. I mean, those are arguments about why the rule doesn't make a whole lot of sense here. But then, for everybody who's ever been through law school, you probably get a visceral reaction that it may not make a whole lot of sense in most contexts. But I guess the question here for us is: did the legislature intend, and with these words, abolish it for all purposes?
Well, I think the short answer is: going forward, abolish for all purposes. Going backwards, this elegant solution. What do? You go back and you add the magic words, That's what it's all about, right? It's about, well, you didn't say a life and being plus 21 years. You said 25 years. So go back and put in that, those magic words. Changing no duties, changing no obligations, just enforcing the bargain that ARCO and Equity agreed to. That's all that's being done here. It seems to me that's the direct, clear instruction of the statute. The Uniform Act, of course, said you may reform. The Colorado statute says shall reform. It's a mandatory directive. If it violates the rule, reform. This is a non-vested property interest. ARCO's trying to give the gotcha on the rule against perpetuities and void this option that they agreed to grant and could have revoked with the gotcha clause. So you didn't have those magic words. And our legislature has said, reform it. Save it from such an absurd.
What are the implications on real property interests going back 100 years, for example? And do you disagree that the rule against perpetuities would have canceled that interest out that didn't meet the rule, and therefore in the chain of title it would go on to other people based on the vesting of the or the retention, let's say, of the property interest with the person that entered into that illegal instrument?
It's a thoughtful question, and going back, all you're doing is reforming to meet the party's own intentions. You're not changing anything. You're not changing their agreement. All you're doing is changing this arcane feudal law that would cut out that negotiated interest.
But it has a significant change in legal effect. And I'm concerned about the fact that parking it here in the probate code doesn't give any notice, really, to people doing regular property and commercial transactions. You can modify, the legislature can certainly modify the common law in part. And instead of adopting a uniform act that applied to everything, you know, you're saying that's their intent. But it comes at the very end here of a probate code provision, very specialty practice, and there you want to carry out the testator's intent. So there seems to be a real policy reason for modifying the common law in that arena that might not apply to property deeds, etc., commercial transactions, and so on.
Well, I think that the amicus brief of the Colorado Bar Association, both probate and real estate, sponsored this, has a really good discussion in the briefing on this point. And I would direct your attention to the Cambridge case in particular. There, a technical, narrow, mechanical application of the rule in Cambridge would have required that the condominium owner's preemptive right was void. There's no doubt about it. The court says so. But the court doesn't apply the rule because it didn't make sense in that context. The Atchison case in 1970 announced that even when we apply the rule, there may be circumstances where there's a limited duration, albeit more than 21 years, that's the language, albeit more than 21 years, that we would still not apply the rule to that interest. So I think the answer to your question is, this was a mess, period. The rule against perpetuities had so many exceptions, and where it was applied and where it wasn't applied, it's a head-scratcher. Professor Leach calls it the reign of terror and says we ought to end it. It didn't add anything to our property law that was constructive. It did give people, on occasion, an ability to say, gotcha, your expectations are gone. Your negotiated interests are kaput. The interest you thought you owned is no longer. Seems to me the rule of the restraint against unreasonable alienation is the better rule. It's the balanced rule. That still would apply. If you looked at a 100-year-old option, you'd still look at that rule. Does it unreasonably restrain alienation? But this common law rule, what's the significance of a life and being plus 21 years to Atlantic Richfield Company? This is a 25-year option. If we picked a life and being lasted 80 years, it'd be a 101-year-old option. So on policy grounds and on planning grounds, seems to me this rule designed to reform, to preserve intent, is exactly the right solution.
All of this, all of your commentary leads me to think, okay, what if we disagree with you about the statutory interpretation and conclude that from the context, this really was only intended to apply to probate? If we move that all back to one side, we're left again with a common law rule, and you seem to be arguing that under Cambridge and some of our other precedent that if this very same case were being presented to us under a common law rule argument only under Cambridge and other precedent, we wouldn't apply the rule in this context. In other words, you could get to where you want to go without having to go the statutory route to get there. Am I disagreeing with you, or am I understanding you? Or
no, that's exactly the argument we made to the trial court.
Look, so what's the effect then of the trial court's ruling against you on that point for us here?
Well, of course, what the trial court did is that I'm going to apply the old common law rule, and I'm also going to apply the Reformation. Taking a step back, I think the factual findings that the intent of the parties was that this would be a valid option and both sides would honor it. That's finding a fact which can't be disturbed. Seems to me that the conclusion of law, whether on these facts, it's revocable, they're co-tenants on the same property, it's not a fixed price, you look at the purpose, does the rule fit? Seems to me from the start, this didn't violate the rule against perpetuities. The trial court disagreed with me on that point, but had the Reformation language to rely upon. I think if you look at Cambridge and Crossroads and Atchison and the dicta in Argus, the rule shouldn't be applied to a situation like this.
Truly, I'm a little troubled by that argument only from a procedural point of view, not so much on the merits. We're bound by the fact you didn't appeal that issue, and the Court of Appeals assumed that it was just a regular option, right? So we have to decide this case not just in regards to the explanation you gave to Justice Marquez. Isn't that right?
I think so, although the leverage case, I think I have the right case, stands, as I understand it, for the proposition that if you're not appealing the result, you don't need to appeal the path by which the court arrived at the result. We agree with the ultimate conclusion that this option is valid, that it should be enforced, and these were the party's intent. We didn't agree with the trial court's.
I understand. You pointed that out in your brief, but we have to take as a fact in this case, or as a predicate, I think, that the common law rule, if applied, would void this option, right? As first step. Isn't that right? I know you argued a little bit in the brief, but you don't present that as a question presented, and it wasn't dealt with by the Court of Appeals. I'm troubled by it procedurally. It isn't so much your colloquy with Justice Marquez. It's how we have to approach it that bothers me.
Yeah, and I understand the tension there. There certainly is a mixed question of law and fact, and I think the inquiry goes to whether or not an appeal is required of the holding that it violates the rule, and there's going to be a reformation by the court of the instrument to enforce that very.
You have a ton of cases that say you don't preserve the issue, you're out of luck.
Mm-hmm.
I recognize that the court can do pretty much what it wants, but it doesn't like to do that.
Right. Understood. And from our point of view, that had been preserved by the fact that the ultimate result in the case was finding that the intent of the parties was going to be honored, that the statute was going to be followed, and the finding of fact was ARCO and Equity agreed to this interest. There was never an assertion that it was void for the rule against perpetuities. It wasn't raised after the pleas were well closed. So that would be my response.
Right, but your fundamental position is that, I guess it's 1107, does it for us, right?
I think 1106.
The tree gets cut completely. And to use your analogy, at the base, no limbs left, right?
Right.
By 1107.
Right. 1106.2 is the specific statute, and we think the trial court got it exactly right. It directs the court, if it finds that the interest violates the rule, the non-vested interest, and we're focusing on equity's interest, not the interest, the equity's non-vested interest. If you find that violates the rule, you shall reform the interest. And I think informative in 1107 is the punctuation mark. That's where the legislature says to us, in addition to this Uniform Act, in addition to strengthening it, from may reform to shall reform. On top of all that, if we weren't clear...
You said that the word shall is used, but it's a presumed, not shall. It's a shall be presumed.
Yes.
That's a presumption, and I'm sure you're familiar with, there are all kinds of presumptions.
There's also the
shifting the burden of proof, etc.
Right. There's also the word that says the court shall reform. And that's what I'm focusing on in 1106.
But that language is very pointedly aimed at probate matters, it seems to me. I mean, it seems to me that even if you're right about the general prospective abolition of the rule against perpetuities, that this reformation provision only had to do with probate instruments. What's your take on that way that subsection 2 is framed there?
Your Honor, I think not, and I think I'd agree with the Argus discussion of this very subsection of the rule. If a non-vested property interest, that's us, equities option was a non-vested property interest, then it says or power of appointment, not us. So if a non-vested property interest created before May 31, 1991, is determined in a judicial proceeding, that happened to us. To violate this state's rule against perpetuities as that rule existed, etc. A court upon petition of an interested person, not limited to probate matters, a person who's interested, that's equity here, shall reform the disposition by inserting a savings clause that preserves most closely the transferor's manifested plan of distribution. Clearly, this is going to apply in probate matters. We don't dispute that for a moment.
And it brings the plan conjunctively, you know, there's no broader statement there. You know, transfers a manifested plan of distribution and brings that plan of distribution within the limits.
Yes.
It's very carefully tailored to just that specific circumstance, the reformation provision, it seems to me. Where do you see broader language there having to do with the reaching back?
I don't see broader language, but I don't think, my reading of that language, as in the Argus case, I do not see that language limits itself to probate matters, because in 1105, when you're talking about non-donative transfers and in the other sections in this act, there's opportunity to say donative or non-donative. The statute doesn't say it is limited to probate matters. And the broader scope of things under the Uniform Act, it's clear under the uniform law and the commentators that the design here was not limited to just a probate purpose. In Colorado in 1107, the legislature...
Is that the language of the Uniform Act, that plan of distribution, etc.?
Is that in the
Uniform Act? Yeah, is that in the Uniform Act? Or is that something that our legislature put in there?
I think it's in there, but I don't want to represent that, Your Honor. I'm not certain that that's the exact language. I believe that this language is the same with the exception of may went to shall. I'd have to compare the two word for word to know whether that phrase is in there as well. 1107, of course, talks about the uniform statutory rule against perpetuities, identifies it. So the Uniform Act and the commentary on the Uniform Act, I would submit, is instructive to the court in interpreting that language. With respect to the actual interest in question, the ARCO's attempt in this case has been to destroy this option completely and ask the court to presume that it is void ab initio. The statutory language, I suggest, instructs the court to presume that the interest is valid. ARCO asks you to presume that you need not reform the instrument. We believe that the statutory language expressly directs that the instrument...
But exercising the option, the whole interest would go to equity, right? And there's not anything left to ARCO.
That's right. What the result here is equity on all these interests.
Yeah.
Sold 50% co-tenancy to ARCO. There was a 25-year payment plan under the agreement. There would be a 25-year buyback.
This may be completely aside from the point, though. You know, they're off on this oil shale adventure. You know, nobody's talking about natural gas, you know. Here's this bonanza there. And boom, equity jumps on this and cuts ARCO out of at least 50% of that. I mean, if you were going to look at the parties, you know, relationship, it started off with a very different premise as to what they were developing, correct?
Well, in part, Your Honor. The facts here are that in 1955, a natural gas well began producing on these lands and was producing the entire time. The parties shared royalties. The facts are that there were surface leases. The parties shared those royalties 50-50 for the surface use. The facts are that in 1982, oil shale was a bust. This didn't work. The parties threw up their hands and said, "Matter what do we want to do?" And the evidence at trial showed ARCO just lost interest. They had things happening in Alaska. They had other fish to fry and just lost interest. They claim they just forgot about it. They had a right to revoke this option. The facts at trial show that in 1995, they hired an individual, former employee, ARCO did, to investigate this, who talked to the equity president and said, "We have a right of first refusal. We also have an option. We can exercise any time, and ARCO, you can revoke that. We don't want to waive it." That ARCO individual valued the property at less than $200,000 for ARCO's interest. So as far as the facts go, Your Honor, as far as what was presented at trial, there's no doubt that there was no windfall going on here at the time. Okay. So that's fine. Obviously, what we are requesting of this court is to affirm the trial court's determination in the ruling on dispositive motions, in the amended ruling on dispositive motions, in the judgment itself. Three times Judge Boyd addressed these very issues. The Court of Appeals decision, which we think was soundly reasoned with respect to the reformation provision. And we're asking that this option be honored and equity's exercise be honored. If there's nothing further, that concludes my remarks. Thank you very much.
Hello?
Justice Marcus, if I may, I'd like to return to your questions regarding the application of the common law rule. I think it would be a serious departure from this court's jurisprudence with respect to the common law rule if the court were to now hold that the common law rule in its perpetuities didn't apply to the option that was created in 1983. Certainly, the cases we've been talking about, Cambridge, Crossroads, all clearly indicate the court's position that commercial options to buy real property are subject to the common law rule. And the only thing I think that could possibly take this out of that would be to say, well, there was a cancellation option here, and so that would remove it from the rule.
Stevenson, that's up for consideration. The same question I asked Mr. Tool.
It's a good question because I understand what you're saying. It's a factual predicate to the entire reformation. And of course, equity didn't appeal the court's grant of the reformation. So in fact, they conceded that it did violate the common law rule, or otherwise they're not entitled to that remedy.
But appeals opinion.
Correct. It does. So yes, I think there are barriers to their even being able to articulate that path to resolution. But even if you considered it, I think it's a dead end anyway. Again, the Colorado law is clear. Commercial options are subject to the rule. And with respect to revocability, again, I'll just raise, there were a lot of facts presented on this issue, including the district court's finding that equity misled Atlantic Richfield into entering into the 1983 amendment in the first place, and that had they not misled them, Atlantic Richfield would have canceled the option shortly after they entered into it. And so in light of those facts, I think those are just further reasons why the common law rule does apply in this case. Let me go now to, back to the statutory interpretation in section 1107, which again, I think just does not speak to the retroactive effect of the statute. It doesn't contain the word retroactivity, it doesn't talk about reformation, it merely says what any statute might say, that is abolishing a common law rule, which is we're abolishing and superseding that rule. But I think those words even imply a prospective application. And so I don't think that mitigates the problem that there is no clear intent expressed by the legislature that this statute apply retroactively to commercial instruments.
Counsel, just briefly, but that any matter language does go to your probate argument, doesn't it?
I'm sorry, any matter?
The any matter language does go to your contextual argument that we're talking about probate here?
Sure, again, because I think that one of the purposes of the act was to abolish the common law rule with respect to commercial instruments going forward. So commercial instruments are now no longer subject to the new statutory rule against perpetuities. So I don't read it as inconsistent. It's simply talking about them prospectively, not retroactively.
So the only place they talk retroactively, in your view, is in the probate context?
Exactly.
And the policy behind them doing that would be what?
Well, I think there may be a policy and there may not be a policy. It may have just been a failure of consideration that they just didn't think about it. But had they thought about it, there would be very good policies to not allow the rule to apply retroactively to commercial instruments. And that is specifically because, as illustrated by this case, to do so would result in unconstitutionally retrospective legislation. The fact of the matter is that ARCO obtained certain rights when that option was signed in 1983, and the legislature can't reach back and change the legal effect of past transactions, which is exactly what would be happening here if you applied the reformation provision to this option. The option was void ab initio. And if you look at the Lake of the Woods versus McHugh case from the Virginia Supreme Court, they encountered the exact same situation and said, yes, the instrument was void ab initio. We can't apply a rule now that might deprive you of the vested property interest that that left you with. And that's exactly where we are now. And I also wanted...
Could I interrupt 1 second? Let's go to 106 again with regard to the prospective application. I mean, 1106.
Yes.
The first section of that makes it prospective only with regard to certain things, and then 2 says about reformation. They both use the same phrase with regard to the kind of dispositions they're talking about. Is there a rationale? What sense does it make for the legislature to have intended in 1106.1 to make the statute applicable, prospectively only, to dispositions that it's not applicable to at all?
I'm trying to follow. I think the 1106.1 is a general statement of prospective application. And subsection 2 is saying we're carving out something from that, and we're going to allow reformation to something that's less than everything. And the question is, when they said that, what were they thinking of? What were they thinking of applying the statute, the reformation provision, retroactively to? And the language of that section strongly indicates that the only thing they were thinking of was probate instruments.
I appreciate that. Let me refine that just slightly to see if there's any slippage between what I'm saying and what you're saying, or what I'm asking. And that is, so in 1, which indicates that Part 11 applies prospectively only, it is with regard to non-vested property interest or a power of appointment. If that means anything more than what 1105 has just said are the interests to which the new statutory rule applies, then it would seem to be superfluous. Why would they have to say it only applies prospectively to this group of dispositions if that group of dispositions is anything more than what they've already said the statute applies to? And where I'm going with that is, if that's true, and they use the identical phrase in 2, then why doesn't the reformation provision, the reference to non-vested property interest or a power of appointment, refer only to those dispositions to which the statutory rule applies in 1105? Is that too complicated to possibly respond to?
I will do my best. I think that the term non-vested property interest is not used with consistency throughout the statute. There are times where it is clearly limited in its application to probate instruments only. There are times where it appears to be something broader than that. And so I think you cannot read that term in the statute without looking at the context in which it's written. And I think the broader point beyond that is, we're not just talking about, could you interpret the statute to read this way? We're talking about, did the legislature clearly express its intent to apply to this certain group of instruments, and I think the language just does not permit.
So what is a non-vested property interest? What's the definition of it?
It's not defined in the Act. It's not defined.
Well, in the practice, what would it be? What's the common understanding?
I don't know that there is any common understanding. I think it's a very generic term. I think, in general, it would be a property interest that had some condition precedent to it becoming a vested property interest.
You seem to be suggesting that it may chameleon-like have a different meaning depending on the section it appears in.
Correct.
Okay.
I see my time is expired.
Yes. Other questions? I want to thank both counsel for your arguments and as well as your briefs. And the case will be submitted on the briefs. The court will be at recess.